What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DiSebato, and this week we discuss why the e-waste problem with e-cigarettes is such a big deal, and then we discuss the most ambitious tailpipe emissions regulation in the U.S. to date. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Stay tuned. I learned about a fascinating new field of study today called garbology. I love the word. It's great. Listen to it. Listen to how it's pronounced.
Garbology.
Garbology is the study of garbage and the environmental contamination caused by garbage. Now, why did I stumble across this stunning word? Because I was talking with my colleague, Ara Toder, who covers the tobacco industry for us, and we were talking about e-cigarettes or vapes that we see casually smoked on the subways, for example. And I found this garbology study while we were talking that was done by the Center for Disease Control that looked at the waste littered around 12 high schools in the San Francisco Bay Area in the U.S. in 2019. And the researchers found that at middle and high income schools, the rate of e-cigarette garbage had increased at an alarming rate, and that it signaled a trend of rising use in students of e-cigarettes. And that was in 2019. Since then, there have been more than 2.5 million middle and high school students in the U.S. that have reported vaping, and around 15 million adults in the U.S. use e-cigarettes currently. And that's just the U.S. Globally, vapes are used by around 55 million people across the world, according to the World Economic Forum. So if we did some sort of massive global garbology study, it is likely that the amount of e-cigarette waste would be quite high. And you may be thinking, well, I see cigarette butts all the time on the ground. It's been a problem for ages, and that is true. And cigarette butts do contain plastic, nicotine, formaldehyde, lead, and cadmium, which are not good for the environment. But emptied pods, also known as cartridges, and vape pens contain all that plus heavy metals and other chemical toxins and hazardous lithium ion batteries that, if not properly disposed of, can leach into soil or sand and create the problems that all e-waste creates for our environment. So if there are millions of people smoking these vapes, then supposedly the tobacco industry must be searching for a plan to deal with the e-waste. So that's what I was talking to Ora about. And I asked her if she could tell me what the tobacco industry is doing, if anything, to deal with this piling up of electronic waste due to e-cigarettes.
E-waste is a new risk for tobacco manufacturers with the investment in these new products. So they don't have, I'm talking about big tobacco particularly, that discloses their sustainability efforts in their reports. They don't discuss much about what they do in relation to e-waste, but there are some initiatives. So Philip Morris, for example, they say that they started recycling rechargeable heated tobacco products, but it doesn't mention anything related to the recycling of vapes, including disposable vapes. British American Tobacco developed Vuse, which is very popular in the UK and in France, and they have containers for device return in their stores, and they've partnered with third-party retailers to recycle vapes. But this might apply more to end-of-life rechargeable vapes rather than disposable vapes, because by definition, they may not be recycled. If consumers hear that something is disposable, they will just dispose of it rather than think that it can be recycled.
So Big Tobacco has not been proactive yet on the issue that their disposable products pose to the environment and society, which is odd because in the UK and the EU, for example, producers of electronics are legally obliged to fund the recycling of a tonnage equivalent to what they put on the market. Yet, as Ora noted, not much has been done, and retailers aren't helping the problem either. In UK, retailers selling more than 100,000 pounds of a product have to actually recycle and offer recycling programs for that product. But when the Financial Times investigated whether this is happening in March of this year, and they visited a cross-section of supermarket brands in central London, none of the staff spoken to were aware of the schemes. And later on, Tesco, Sainsbury, and the Co-op, they're called, told the paper that they are introducing more training for staff on this issue. But this can be pretty risky for Big Tobacco because vapes have been marketed as a new way forward for the tobacco industry. They were said to be healthier than traditional smoking, which is true, but critics say it's sort of like saying being stabbed is less bad than being shot. But vapes were seen as the way forward for big tobacco, the way they can remake their image in modern times. Yet this environmental problem just adds to all the other social issues that tobacco has been facing, even with its newer product.
Tobacco companies, from a social point of view, had a big impact and risks both upstream in their supply chain and downstream. So obviously downstream with issues like consumer health, but also upstream because the big tobacco companies have been the target of NGOs that investigated working conditions and child labor on tobacco leaf farms. So these social issues have always been present in the tobacco companies' supply chains. But with more investment into alternative tobacco products, now big tobacco becomes exposed to the electronic supply chain, which carries social risk on it of its own. There have been multiple cases of poor labor standards and working conditions in the manufacturing of electronic devices, particularly in emerging markets. And that's not the only social risk related to alternative tobacco products. You also sourcing critical minerals such as cobalt for lithium-ion batteries can have a social risk because it may finance and exacerbate conflict in natural resource-rich countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Now, it's not like the lithium-ion batteries that e-cigarettes use contain a massive amount of precious metals, but they have enough where if they are quickly disposed of by the millions of vapors out there, it builds up. For example, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism found that in the UK, two disposable vapes are being thrown away every second. In over a year, this is enough lithium to make roughly 1,200 electric car batteries. That's a good amount. So you could say the tobacco industry is building up its exposure to risks presented by the social pillar in ESG. And sometimes, when those risks begin to build, or in the case of the tobacco industry, to start to pile on top of legacy social risks that have plagued big tobacco since its downfall in the 90s, we could start to see the storm of regulation brewing on the horizon.
Regulators are looking into regulating vapes because of the uptick in youth consumption particularly. So the EU plans to impose a vaping tax, which would increase the price of disposable vapes, and in turn, it may decrease consumption. And the plan is to tax more heavily vaping products that have a higher nicotine content, because you can also get vapes that don't have any nicotine content or very low. Now, the UK government, you know, traditionally they've endorsed vapes as a solution to quit smoking, but even they are considering now introducing a vape excise tax. And a couple of days ago, they've launched a consultation on banning flavored vapes and will also set up a task force to crack down on retailers selling vapes to teenagers. And some jurisdictions like the US and China have bans in place for flavored vapes, and others like Brazil and India have even banned vapes altogether. So I would say the EU and the UK are reacting rather late to the uptick of teenager consumption of vapes, when other regulations have banned vapes altogether quite a while ago.
And look, these bans do hit the valuation of companies. In 2020, Juul had to cut its valuation to about 10 billion US from an estimated 38 billion US 2 years earlier, what it was valued at, due to regulatory setbacks, lawsuits, and reputational damage from an outbreak and lung injuries among vapers. And there's another example, because flavored vape products bans took place in the US in 2020. So what the tobacco industry lobby said was that sales were expected to fall by around 2.7 billion US, and the overall economy would see a $7.3 billion hit. Now, these lobbyists were obviously trying to argue against the banning of flavored vapes with those figures, so they are to be taken with a grain of salt, but it gives a good picture of the possible risk that a ban on a product could have due to a social backlash on its use and what the industry thinks about that. And now, these bans that have been introduced to vapes and e-cigarettes are not solely because of this e-waste problem that we were talking about. They were due, in part, due to concerns around social health. But it's not like environmental concerns were being forgotten by regulators. The EU is set to pass a regulation this year that would make replaceable or rechargeable batteries in all consumer products mandatory by 2027, which will affect disposable e-cigarettes. And the US is marshaling support from a similar regulation. And now this is without mentioning that the demand for lithium and cobalt, which are used in e-cigarette batteries and vape batteries, are going to compete with the global rush to electrify our economies. Smoking may take a back seat to the greater societal needs for these metals. And these are all risks that the tobacco industry is going to have to pay attention to going forward. On last week's episode of ESG Now, we've discussed why air pollution is a very serious problem and is responsible for around 1 in 6 deaths worldwide. And they were talking about how the problem of an unchecked miasma of toxic air was the catalyst of much of the modern-day environmental movement that we know today. And it's the visibility of this miasma that makes it easy for policymakers to say, just look outside and see why we are doing what we're doing for the environment. If there's a lot of smog, people will react to it. Now, Jurgita and Simon focused on India, but if we travel all the way to the U.S., a new regulation by the Environmental Protection Agency is trying to deal with air quality issues. Earlier this month, the EPA announced a proposal to reduce emissions from both passenger and commercial vehicles by 2032, making it the most ambitious proposal of its kind that the U.S. has ever seen. And the proposal takes air quality as a starting point. And I'm quoting here, it aims to, quote, improve air quality for communities across the nation, especially communities that have borne the burden of polluted air. Now, there's this thing called the Federal Fuel Economy Standards in the U.S., and this is not the same as that, but it kind of extends this, and it says that a car maker's average fleet emissions must be at or below 82 grams of CO2 per mile by the 2032 model year. And what is even more important about this regulation, and sort of unusual, is that it requires medium-duty trucks to have average fleet emissions to be at or below 275 grams of CO2 per mile by the same year. And so I asked my colleague, Yu Ishihara, who covers the automobile industry for us, to put that all into perspective. And if it's fair for me to say that such an ambitious regulation could effectively moonlight the internal combustion engine as we know it.
Let's just take this in the context of passenger cars. And this new target represents a 56% reduction by 2032 from existing federal standards, which, you know, extend only up through 2026. And to put that into context of how ambitious this new EPA proposal is, the current federal targets mandate a 5% annual reduction between 2023 to 2026 for passenger cars. But these new EPA targets more than double that to around 13% annual reduction from 2026 to 2032. And so clearly it promotes a much more aggressive trajectory for the carbon neutral transition for the automotive sector in the United States.
A doubling of existing annual emission reduction targets is significant. To put this into context, EPA estimates suggest that the proposal package would avoid 10 billion tons of CO2, which is twice the total carbon emissions that the U.S. emitted last year. Also importantly, by meeting these standards, the U.S. would reduce its reliance on fossil fuels, which is needed if the U.S. is going to achieve its net zero 2050 goal and would be a benefit to the world's carbon reduction emission schemes because the U.S. is one of the largest polluters out there. But this is a considerate acceleration of low carbon vehicle promotion. So I ask you if companies are ready for this kind of acceleration.
So there would be several challenges. And I think the obvious one is, you know, the feasibility of manufacturers to actually achieve these targets. You know, is there quite an aggressive step up from the trajectory of previous U.S. ambitions? But, you know, companies like GM, Ford, Nissan, and Volkswagen, you know, they had previously already announced targets to be 40 to 50% zero emission vehicle sales by 2030 in the U.S., which effectively aligned them with the Biden administration's targets. And overall, if you looked across the spectrum of, you know, automotive manufacturers that had announced, you know, either regional EV or zero emission vehicle sales targets, the majority of them had assumed that the U.S. was going to be a relative laggard in terms of adoption compared to, you know, other regions like the EU or China, which already had, you know, either aggressive, you know, emissions regulations or even combustion engine ban targets in place. So I think, you know, if this new EPA proposal does come into effect, manufacturers may have to reconsider those targets and potentially, you know, reprioritize their investments and product launches towards the U.S. to meet these new EPA requirements. So, you know, in terms of which companies are best positioned for purely meeting emission reduction standards, you know, the obvious nod would go to pure EV manufacturers like Tesla.
The thing is, this is the stick. The stick being, if automakers don't do this, then they will be hit with regulatory fines and reprimands. Autos aren't a public good, though. They operate in a capitalist society, and they have to be bought. There needs to be a carrot along with the stick. And that carrot was in part provided by the Inflation Reduction Act, where there were a certain amount of tax incentives for consumers to purchase electric vehicles. But I don't know about you, but I haven't seen a lot of infrastructure around that needs to deal with any sort of increased use in, let's say, electric vehicles or just low-carbon vehicles in general. So the carrot needs to be multi-formed. There needs to be consumer desire, and there needs to be an availability of infrastructure to meet that consumer demand. And I asked you whether he was seeing any of that already happening that could prepare for this EPA regulation.
We've already seen, several manufacturers make significant announcements for investment, like Hyundai, GM, Toyota, and Ford, to build, EV battery manufacturing facilities within the U.S. Even beyond that, if manufacturers can produce enough EVs to meet the EPA targets, and they can build out the supply chain to make their cars eligible for federal rebates, such a massive uptick in EV adoption, it would also need to come with the requisite charging infrastructure investment. This again is also being incentivized by the federal government via the bipartisan infrastructure law, but only at a limited scale, and it's probably not enough to support such a massive shift to EVs as the EPA would predict. So you would either need to see, more investment and more federal support in charging, or, possible development of alternate zero-emission vehicles using alternative fuels like hydrogen. But, all of these would also come with similar issues around lack of infrastructure, affordability, and consumer willingness to purchase.
So there are challenges still, and it seems that they are almost beyond the control of car companies in a way. Building charging stations isn't the same thing as building a car in a factory that is under the control of the company. So for the EPA, there might be some pushback by those automakers, but for their credit, they've said that they think that these sort of aggressive policies, the EPA said this, need to be in place to incentivize a transition. And the Biden administration said he wanted to target 40 to 50% annual cars sold in the U.S. to be zero emissions by 2030 anyway. And this EPA regulation is similar to the EU plan to have 100% of cars sold by 2035 at zero emissions. And it's also almost similar to what California is doing. California is pushing for these same sort of rules in their state for 70% of cars to be low carbon vehicles. But it should be noted that this regulation is technologically agnostic. We've been kind of discussing EVs as though the EPA said they were forcing everyone to buy EVs, but they are not doing that. They just want to cut the emissions of passengers and mid-sized trucks. So I wanted to know from you if you thought this was the best way forward, this sort of open-ended, tech-agnostic approach to regulation, and here's what he had to say.
I guess critics would argue that targeting fleet emissions is not good enough, seeing that it doesn't preclude manufacturers to continue to develop combustion engine technology or, other alternative fuels to potentially meet these targets. And I guess the argument there is that any investment dollar spent on developing internal combustion technology could be considered an opportunity cost for that same company to invest in zero carbon technology. But, ultimately, the auto industry transition, it's about reducing fleet emissions, not explicitly about proliferating EVs. And so I think from, a policy mission standpoint, it stands to be pretty in line with other similar initiatives around the world.
And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Aura and you for talking to me about the news with an ESG twist. I wanted to thank you so much for listening. A special thanks to Gabriella De La Serna and Margarita Grabert, my colleagues, for help with this episode. And remember, if you like what you heard, don't forget to rate and review us. That helps get us up on those podcast lists. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I am off next week, but Bentley Kaplan will be joining you. So I will talk to you soon and have a good one.
The MSCI ESG Research Podcast is provided by MSCI Inc. subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research, LLC, a registered investment advisor, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, and this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to, nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or promotional recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.